So my our objective today, or for the first 30 minutes, is to talk about esophageal motility disorders as well as functional disorders. So I have three objectives to hopefully achieve with you today. Number one is to define and diagnose primary esophageal motility and functional disorders. Two, to identify the appropriate diagnostic testing and learn the clinical utility of esophageal manometry. So I will spend a fair amount of time on that. And then lastly, to discuss therapies for the treatment of functional esophageal disorders, which, as we all know, is very challenging. But we'll go through some of the data. So let's start with talking about the motor as well as sensory control of the esophageal motor function. So basically, the gut is lined by smooth muscle, and the nerve innervation comes from or stems from the dorsal motor nucleus of the brain, and the nerve fibers from the dorsal motor nucleus of the brain runs through the vagus nerve and then innervates the plexi within the stomach, small intestine, as well as esophageal wall. There are two major plexi that compose what's called the enteric nervous system, which controls both motor function as well as sensory function of the gut. The first one is the myenteric plexus, or the Arbox plexus. You may remember this from school, and it runs between the longitudinal and the circular muscle of the esophagus and the remainder of the intestinal wall. And then the Meissner's plexus, which runs within the submucosa. And within that plexi, it's a very complex system where you have the nerves, the muscles, and the neurotransmitters that interact to control, like I said, motor function, sensory function, and also secretory function of the gut. And it's intimately connected with the central nervous system. That's going to become important, or it is important, with pretty much everything we're going to talk about this weekend. So when there's some dysfunction, either at the level of the smooth muscle or the neurotransmitters or within the nerves or even the central processing of these motor and sensory functions, patients can develop various esophageal symptoms such as heartburn, regurgitation, chest pain, dysphagia, which may be to liquid and or solids, and also odynophagia, which is more proximal, or pain, excuse me, with swallowing. So as far as where we start to evaluate these patients with esophageal disorders, of course, history. You cannot supplement a good history with any of the diagnostic tests that we're going to talk about. Physical exam, typically it's normal, but sometimes you can pick up some systemic causes of esophageal motor function, such as rashes associated with connective tissue disorders, perhaps someone who is having oropharyngeal dysphagia. They may have a huge thyroid that's causing extrinsic compression and obstruction, or mass even in the neck. So, of course, those two things are most important, and that's going to help to inform the rest of what you do for these patients. Barium swallow, it's actually, you know, a lot of times we don't order it anymore, but it actually still is very good to rule out mechanical causes of dysphagia, such as looking for Zenker's diverticulum, strictures, webs, and rings. But that's very different from sort of the other sensory and motor disorders that we're going to talk about. And of course, endoscopy, our favorite. You know, and there's some discussion whether do we just go straight to endoscopy, or do we start out with the barium swallow? Traditionally, we've been taught start out with the barium swallow. Make sure that you get a good roadmap of the esophagus before you go to scope. But there's some discussion around that, because you can not only diagnose any potential obstruction, but also relieve that obstruction when you're doing the upper endoscopy, and then also you get good mucosal assessment. And then really, in terms of esophageal motility disorders, esophageal high-resolution manometry is the gold standard to assess these disorders. So the high-resolution manometry, and commonly now it's combined with intraluminal impedance manometry. So we'll talk more about the high-resolution, but it basically it's an improved sort of version of conventional manometry. And the difference is that you have many more sensors along the pressure catheter that's placed in the patient's esophagus. And you can pick up more discrete, you know, motility disorders and which may inform your decisions about treatment. And when you combine it with an intraluminal impedance, and the impedance piece of this is looking at the resistance to flow of whatever the bolus is that you're giving the patient. And so we can look at bolus transit along the esophagus as well. So why do we do manometry? We shouldn't do it on everybody, but who should we perform manometry on? So the most rewarding indication for manometry is in patients who are presenting to you with dysphagia. Patient, you know, we oftentimes order for other reasons such as chest pain, you know, reflux, plus minus. It's not potentially helpful in terms of assessing reflux. Only when you're trying to do the pH testing and you need to know where to put the manometry catheter, that's where it becomes helpful. But essentially, it helps you to assess for any primary motility disorders such as achalasia or spastic disorders. And we see that probably in about 5% of patients who present with dysphagia. As far as chest pain, not so helpful, but it may be indicated in patients who have had an inconclusive workup after you've done a endoscopy and other evaluations. And as far as secondary motility disorders, it can be helpful in looking at patients who may have esophageal manifestations of scleroderma, other connective tissue disorders, pseudoobstruction, which we know is a you know, a GI tract wide disorder, diabetes, Parkinson's disease, and other myopathies. So as I mentioned, the other reason why we do manometry is the preoperative evaluation for reflux disease. And really, it's most useful to look to determine where you want to put that pH probe. And we typically put it 5 centimeters above the border of the lower esophageal sphincter so that the manometry helps you to assess where that sphincter is. And it also helps you to evaluate the effectiveness of peristalsis or contractile function of the esophagus before you do Nissen fundoplication on the patient, because you want to make sure they have good contraction vigor so that they don't have more dysphagia or other problems after surgery. So just to go over again with you, so the high-resolution manometry technology, there's 36 closely spaced pressure transducers along the catheter, and you can see it sort of lined along the catheter from distally, proximally. And that pressure data is transformed into these beautiful, I love them, I get really excited, I can't wait to show you. But these beautiful color spatial temporal plot displays. And it basically assesses where the upper esophageal sphincter is, esophageal motor function, and then lower esophageal sphincter. It is more precise than the conventional manometry that we do because it has more of the sensors that I mentioned to you. And it reduces the interpretation variability. And we know there's a lot of that depending on, you know, who does the test, who's interpreting the test. And the high-resolution technology helps to reduce that. And they're very, you know, well-thought-out criteria for making motility a diagnosis, which I'll go through with you. And these metrics that I mentioned, they're based on the Chicago classification, and it has been updated recently to the version 3, which I will go over that with you. So, and then as far as the intraluminal impedance manometry, that is combined with the high-resolution manometry, the pressure, but here we're looking at changes in resistance to current flow. And that is measured as impedance. And we do that, there's these metal electrode rings that are also included on that catheter to look at the change in flow of that bolus transit. And it allows us to assess esophageal clearance, and I mentioned bolus transit, but also allows us to look at retrograde or reflux transit. So in patients with GERD, with rumination, and with belching, it can be very useful. Okay, and so here's that picture I was trying to get for you. So this is an example of a normal high resolution manometer. I do have a laser pointer. So as I mentioned, when the pressure transducers along the catheter allows you to look at the upper esophageal sphincter, which at rest, it's typically closed. So just to give you a reference point, so high pressures are red, sort of magenta, hot. Low pressure are your blues, your cool colors. So this is the upper esophageal sphincter, which is at rest, normally closed, so that's higher pressure. Lower esophageal sphincter pressure at rest, again, closed. So it's somewhere around 40 millimeters of mercury normally. When a patient swallows, which we can see up here, the upper esophageal sphincter opens, and so the pressure drops. You have more of your blues. And then you have that nice propagative contraction along the body of the esophagus right here. And so it should be a nice slope, and that's your peristaltic wave, okay? And then simultaneously, the lower esophageal sphincter opens up. Again, your blues, your lower pressure, allows that contraction to move through, and then when the contraction reaches the distal esophagus, it closes and it's at rest again. So it's just a beautiful thing. Whew. So now, and then when you add the impedance component of this, and it doesn't reflect well on this big screen, but what I'm trying to show you is that, so we can, this thing is very sensitive. So you can see sort of the magenta, which is the water, the wet swallows that we give the patient. And normally, once the patient swallows, that magenta should move through and clear and drop into the stomach. And this is gastric pressure down here. But in someone who has decreased bolus transit, because with the impedance technology, we can see that more of that bolus, that fluid is sitting in the body of the esophagus, because again, we're able to look at resistance to flow. And so we can see the bolus is sitting there. It should clear. So with that combination, again, we're looking at esophageal contraction or that peristaltic wave, and then trying to correlate it with bolus transit. Now, in terms of the data, they don't always correlate one to one, but it can be very helpful when you're trying to assess your patient's symptoms, who says, you know, I just, the liquid or the food just gets stuck here. And you can look and order a manometry and assess whether there's some defects in that motor function, as well as whether the bolus is actually moving through or not. Okay? So in terms of the metrics that we look at, there are a lot of different metrics that the Chicago classification has included, but there are four major ones to help us to determine whether someone has a primary esophageal motor disorder. So we look at, and I don't want to get too technical, but we look at the median integrated relaxation pressure, which is the IRP, which is essentially the residual pressure once the lower esophageal sphincter maximally relaxes. So what is left? Right? And so normally it should be very close to zero. Certainly should be less than 8 millimeters of mercury pressure. If it's higher than 15, then we know that it's not relaxing appropriately. And so your patient may present with, you know, dysphagia and the food is getting stuck right here, right? And it may be because that sphincter is not opening completely. And the manometry will help you determine that. The second major thing that we look at is the distal contractile integral, which is the contraction vigor. And I'll show you some images of that, but it's basically looking at the volume of the contraction. We also look at the distal latency, which is how fast the contraction is moving down the esophagus. So if it moves too quickly, we see that sometimes in patients who have spasm, right? And that can present with dysphagia or chest pain. And I think it's very helpful if you understand that. So when you get these reports back, you know, what the heck, they're saying to you, right? Because they'll say the DL is this and the IRP. Well, you kind of, you know, you'll know what that means now and what you need to potentially do with it. And then the last thing is looking at breaks in that bolus contour, and I'll show you some of that. And now these breaks, if they're more than 5 centimeters in terms of the length, then that's considered a significant break. And that can, we can see that in patients who have dysphagia because the motor function is just ineffective or fragmented. So in terms of your primary motility disorders, so they fall into really three major categories. First one is normal, right? So that's when your residual pressure is normal. It's not real high, so the LES relaxes well. And then you have greater than 50% of effective swallows. So they're moving through effectively. You're no significant breaks, so that's normal. In terms of other problems you may have are disorders of the esophageal-gastric junction outflow, so when that LES doesn't relax. And so we see that in achalasia potentially, and of course there's three types. And then we also see that in just basic outflow obstruction, but it's not achalasia. It's just that the lower esophageal sphincter doesn't open completely. And we see that in patients who have had Nissen fundoplication, so that's not so abnormal in these patients. But there are other disorders in which it just doesn't relax. So we think that's because of some dysfunction at the level of the enteric nervous system or even some of the neurotransmitters at that level that help the sphincter to relax. And then so we characterize that as incompletely expressed achalasia, which is tough to diagnose in mechanical obstruction. Other major disorders of peristalsis, we have diffuse esophageal spasm. That's when you have greater than 20% what we call simultaneous contractions, so they're very fast. Jackhammer is when that vigor is very, very high, and at least 20% of contraction, so it's greater than 8,000. And these patients can present with chest pain and as well as dysphagia. And then you also have absent contractility, so you just don't get that nice, beautiful peristaltic wave that I showed you. And then minor disorders of peristalsis, you have ineffective motility. Sometimes we see that in patients who have dysphagia but also have some GERD because the esophagus is not clearing the acid or the non-acid into the stomach and just sitting there, and it's causing symptoms as well as perhaps some esophageal damage. And then your fragmented peristalsis is when you have big breaks. This is an example of a fragmented peristalsis. So the initial normal one I showed you, so that nice peristaltic wave, here it's all blue here. You're not seeing that nice contraction, that peristaltic wave. And then also the bolus is not emptying very well either, so some of that magenta is staying in the esophagus. With esophageal spasm, again, you have more simultaneous contractions, so greater than 20%, and this is reflected here. This is what your typical image looks like, and sometimes you have multi-peak contractions, which is reflected by these high-pressure areas in the contraction. And then jackhammer, I mentioned to you, is when you have that elevated, what we call the distal contractile integral. So it's the contraction vigor is very, very high. Commonly, these patients will present with chest pain and dysphagia. And this has to occur in at least 20% of of your wet swallows that you do during the manometry. And so this is a very voluminous contraction, so just huge volume. So in terms of how we treat these patients, it's very difficult. We oftentimes start with proton pump inhibitors. There's no good data to suggest they work, but anecdotally, oftentimes patients who have reflux disease can have spasm because of it. So if you can control the reflux, perhaps you can control the spasm. Calcium channel blockers have been evaluated, and they're mixed results in very small trials. Diltiazem, 60 to 90 milligrams 4 times a day, has actually proved to be better than placebo in terms of controlling symptoms in patients with spasm and with jackhammer esophagus. But this was a small study, only 22 patients. They looked at nifedipine as well, but there were no change in symptoms. It did decrease the contraction amplitudes, or that volume I showed you, but it didn't necessarily result in a change of symptoms. Nitrates, there have been no randomized trials, so it's not clear. And also, it's been limited in terms of the side effect profile in these patients. Tricyclic antidepressants, I love them for many reasons. But they actually have been proven to be helpful in patients with spasm and with jackhammer. Trazodone, 100 milligrams to 150, has been shown to decrease chest pain in patients with spasm and as well as jackhammer esophagus, which used to be nutcracker esophagus, called nutcracker. I just want to make sure that's clear. Okay, now we're calling it jackhammer. Yeah. So that, okay, good. Yeah, you got to stay with it. It changes every day. So, but it has been shown to be helpful and compared to placebo. So what I'll typically do is start a patient who, and sometimes I don't necessarily do the mnemometry, but oftentimes I do, just to make sure there's no other primary motility disorders such as achalasia. But if it's, but if we see that there's a spasm or jackhammer, even sometimes when it's normal, I will start at a very low dose of trazodone, like 25 milligrams at night, because it is sedating, and then take them up as necessary, and also or use a tricyclic antidepressant. And oftentimes, it may help these patients at many levels. Amipramine also has been shown to reduce chest pain by 52%. And these are all small studies, though, granted. So as far as other potential treatments, sildenafil has been looked at, small trials, but shown to reduce LES pressure and that amplitude of the esophageal contraction in spasm and in jackhammer. Other drugs for just typical non-cardiac chest pain, theophylline has been tried, but you know, I actually have never tried that in a patient, just too nervous about the potential side effects, and we have other therapies, and then also SSRIs or sertraline. So I want to show you also sort of what a manometry looks like in someone who has a connective tissue disorder. So this is a manometry in someone who has scleroderma. And so what happens in scleroderma is that you get atrophy and fibrosis of the smooth muscle. And so as you can see, so the UES, upper esophageal sphincter, looks pretty good. It's the resting pressure is pretty good. It opens nicely. But there is nothing happening at the level of the body of the esophagus. There's no pressure changes. There's no peristalsis. And so these patients oftentimes have dysphagia. But also, more commonly, they have reflux disease, too, and strictures, because they're not clearing the esophagus. Things are just sitting. And then you can also see that at the lower esophageal sphincter, it's just the pressure is just sort of dicey. It's shoddy. You don't have that nice high-pressure zone, that area that I showed you previously, there are breaks, and so these patients are predisposed to reflux disease. So let's go with this. I want to talk to you about this case in the time that we have, and I want you guys to tell me what you think. Don't be nervous. We're all friends, or we will be by Sunday, okay? So we have a case of a 38-year-old male who presents with a 7-year history of chest pain and heartburn. Initially, his symptoms responded to PPI. However, a year ago, he began having worsening dysphagia to both liquids and solids, a slight cough, choking at night, and also he said he was bloated, not really sure where that came from, but 20-pound weight loss. So physical exam is unremarkable. He did have an endoscopy by another physician. His esophagus was dilated. His manometry showed low resting LES pressure, and there was no esophageal peristalsis. So what do you guys think may be going on with this gentleman? Just put it out there. Okay, so someone said it could be a connective tissue, right? And I assume you're saying that because the LES pressure is low, okay? Anything else? Mm-hmm. Right, okay. So good. So certainly in the differential diagnosis. Anything else? His esophagus is dilated too, though. I threw you guys off. I know I did. Yeah, somebody said achalasia. Absolutely. So that's in there. Okay. Anything else? Okay, good. So given what we think is going on, so he had a manometry already. He had an EGD already. What else would you do? A manometry? Okay. Okay, all right, good. Okay, so we will do that. But first of all, it's achalasia. And I know I threw you off with that low LES pressure, right? Remember, that's not the primary metric or criteria that you need for a diagnosis of achalasia. The primary thing is absent peristalsis, and then obviously you have to do the additional workup and the symptoms and so forth to make the correct diagnosis. So achalasia, the prevalence is it's rare, but for some reason we see a lot of it. But it presents usually with dysphagia to liquids and solids, also with regurgitation as a common symptom. Patients will have chest pain, about 30% of patients, and also patients will present with cough or heartburn. The cough is because it's the liquid or the food is not passing into the stomach very well, and they have aspirations or even microaspiration. What causes achalasia is that you get this inflammatory infiltrate of the myenteric plexus. At least that's what we think is going on, and it interrupts that nerve innervation that I talked to you about and disrupts the inhibitory effect of the neurons, as well as we think nitric oxide to allow for that proper relaxation. Typically you have incomplete relaxation of the lower esophageal sphincter, that is typical, and absent peristalsis, that's the big thing, that's most important. So this is a manometry. It's not his manometry, but it is a manometry of typical manometry of a type 2 achalasia, where you have this, what we call this pan pressurization of the esophagus. So again, upper esophageal sphincter, lower esophageal sphincter, very high pressure here. And when we give the patient, these are these wet swallows that we give them, you just get this pan sort of compartmentalization syndrome where it just all kind of pressurizes and you just get a vertical sort of pressure band along from proximal to distal, as opposed to that nice peristaltic wave that I showed you previously. And so this is classic, and this is what you typically see. Of course, type 1 and type 3 are very different, but this is sort of one of the classical type 2 achalasia manometry patterns that we see. With a barium swallow, typically we have, so this is the lower esophageal sphincter, this is distal esophagus, and you see when you give the patient the barium, it just barely seeps through, and so we have this bird's beak appearance, right? Just barely seeping through because the lower esophageal sphincter is not opening very well at all. And then this is just the image of a dilated, debris-filled esophagus where the food and the secretions are just sitting. So how do we treat it? The calcium channel blockers, again, have been tried, small studies. Nifedipine has been shown to decrease LES pressure by about 20 to 40% compared to placebo, but didn't see a huge change in symptoms. I typically don't try calcium channel blockers because of the potential side effects, and my patients just have so many other pulmonary and cardiac issues and the benefit just has not proven to be so great. So I typically don't start with those. Nitrates have also been assessed or evaluated. The nitrates do reduce LES pressure, but the effects are short-lived and, again, high side effects. In terms of endoscopic treatments, Botox, I mean, it was really hot for, a good minute in the 90s and early 2000s, but we realized it doesn't last very long. If you get 2-3 months from Botox injections of the LES in these patients, you're good. So it's very short-lived. Pneumatic dilation, there's no one in our center that does it, but it has been shown to be very effective, particularly in older patients who, you want to give them, time and significant amount of time, but you don't necessarily want to send them for surgery. The perforation rate, it probably is a little lower now, probably more like 5%, but it's really being supplanted by peroral endoscopic myotomy or POEM, which is really starting to be very, very helpful in many patients. Other surgical treatments for achalasia, your myotomy, that's sort of the gold, the standard for now, but GI is coming through. And it has been shown to relieve symptoms, have like a 93% relief of symptoms, and then the remission about 80% at 10 years, so it's actually very good. But these patients may develop severe reflux in about 10% of cases, and therefore typically a DOR, which is a partial fundoplication, is done simultaneously to prevent reflux in that, because you're cutting that lower esophageal sphincter. And of course, esophagectomy for end-stage dilated cases in which the esophagus is just not, even if you cut the muscle, the esophagus is just not, you know, contracting, not moving, you need to cut these patients. So this patient underwent a DOR fundoplication and did well, and myotomy, excuse me. So just lastly, in the 10 seconds that I have, the functional esophageal disorders, this is a series of typically four disorders that either present with functional chest pain, functional heartburn, globus, or functional dysphagia. And typically the core sort of the central pathophysiology is visceral hypersensitivity. Again, you know, of course you want to do the proper workup, potentially endoscopy, manometry, barium swallow. But, you know, once you start talking to these patients, you get that feel. You know that this is more of a functional disorder, meaning that there's no mechanical, structural, or histopathologically based motility disorder in these patients. And so, you want to make sure you reassure them by doing the appropriate workup. Typically, the manometries are normal, but in patients with functional dysphagia, particularly older patients, you can find some weak peristalsis in these patients, some large defects, and some of these patients may have failed peristalsis. So as I mentioned, primarily what you want to do with these patients is to reassure them, right, that, you know, I know I ruled out you do not have a big mass in your esophagus, there's no reflux, at least not as the primary cause. You want to tell them to avoid the triggers. Antidepressants have been shown to be useful, and other psychological therapies such as cognitive behavioral therapy. As far as the antidepressants, there was a recent meta-analysis done by Weigenberg, and it was actually published this year. And they looked at, sort of did a systemic review and looked at antidepressants in these functional esophageal disorders, and really only showed that for globus and functional chest pain, there were some good studies done. For globus, there was a 75% response for amitriptyline versus 36% for pantoprazole. So that's something to consider, or even nortriptyline. And again, globus is a sensation of something being in the upper esophagus, and this can occur with or without eating. Functional chest pain, again, it's not a burning pain, it's not GERD, it's, you know, just often patients will say, it feels like an elephant is sitting on my chest. You've ruled out cardiac disease and done the other appropriate workup, and you may want to consider an SSRI or a tricyclic antidepressant. So my key take-home points is that, that heartburn, chest pain, and dysphagia are very common symptoms of esophageal motility disorders, so think about that, or it could be a functional disorder. The etiology is complex, but clearly there's some dysfunction, oftentimes, particularly in the functional disorder patients, between sort of the central processing of pain. And then also high-resolution manometry is a very important tool to assess patients who have esophageal symptoms such as dysphagia. And then the treatment of functional esophageal disorders largely depends on managing and modulating that visceral, that gut hypersensitivity. So thank you very much, and I look forward to meeting with you soon.